listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Within the astonishing range of subjects that he's written about, Jeff Dyer's fascination with war and the military emerges time and again. He's explained its origin in his childhood, how for boys of his generation in Britain, the war was a unifying experience that became part of the collective consciousness, which is part of the motivation that explains his choice, given other possible scenarios, to become writer-in-residence for 2 weeks on the aircraft carrier USS H.W. Bush. And it wasn't an easy fit, literally. The food was bad, the bed was lumpy, and tall Jeff was constantly bumping his head. But Jeff Dyer is at home with discomfort. He makes a study of it, and he puts his brilliant curiosity to good use, describing the crew and their dangerous, difficult work in ways both admiring and hilarious in his newest book, Another Great Day at Sea, which he'll be discussing with Howard tonight. And I was rereading, actually, another of Jeff's books, Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It, one of my favorite titles, where he writes of a time in his youth when he lived in Rome. He says in the grand manners of, he was living there in the grand manner of writers, meaning basically, I did nothing all day, which we know isn't really true. But during that particular sojourn in Rome, he talked about how he became obsessed with the idea of making a movie, though he knew, he wrote, there would be a frustrating shortfall between the majesty of my cinematic conception and the technical means of realizing it. So never mind making movies, he just walked around seeing movies everywhere on the street, and he thought a great deal about film, and later he was to write a very marvelous book about film called Zona, about Andrei Tarkovsky's Stalker, which was part of the reason I thought it would be very interesting to pair Jeff tonight with Howard Rodman, who is both an award-winning screenwriter and a professor of screenwriting at USC, a past artistic director of the Sundance Film Labs, as well as an excellent conversationalist. A bit about Jeff Dyer. He was born in Cheltenham, England, where his dad was a sheet metal worker and his mother worked in a school canteen. He was educated at Oxford. He commented to Matthew Spector in an excellent interview in the Paris Review that, quote, in this entirely passive way, all I did was keep passing exams from 11 onwards. And as Matthew Spector noted, quote, such a relaxed account, of course, does nothing to explain the singular restlessness of Dyer's writing, its ranginess of subject, its comic energy, or its sheer volume. And that sheer volume of writing includes, among others, Zona, Paris Trance, Out of Sheer Rage, a National Book Critics Circle Award finalist, Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi, and otherwise known as The Human Condition. Also, I wanted to note that Jeff's first two novels, The Color of Memory and The Search, have also just been published for the very first time in the United States. They're for sale tonight, courtesy of our library store, and they make great companion reading to his new nonfiction book. So now to discuss the writer he became, or the writer he is not, please welcome Jeff Dyer and Howard Rodman. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise, and thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Howard.
And thank you all for being here. I don't know if you've ever seen a discussion like this with no one in the audience, but it's dismal, and this is much better. I was listening to radio about 10 days ago as I was driving in my car, and among the news items was that the aircraft carrier, the USS George H.W. Bush, had been moved, I love that locution, had been moved from the northern Arabian Sea to the Persian Gulf as part of our, I love this word too, response to what was going on in Iraq. And I think normally I would have thought of the sort of geopolitics of it or sort of the, you know, the sort of poetics of saber rattling. But instead I thought of you.
Well, I'm very touched.
And I guess what I would like to just start talking about, if I can, you wrote, of all the kinds of writers I'm not, a reporter is right at the top of the list. But when, I believe it was Alain de Botton asked you to be part of his Writers in Residence series, you chose up to take residence on an aircraft carrier in a reportorial capacity. This seems so unlike you in so many ways, which is probably why you did it, but well, what were you thinking?
Well, I was thinking, like any professional writer, you know, great, a chance to get out of the house. And, you know, over the years, I've developed this, I can smell out a free trip at, you know, at a considerable distance. And, you know, this was, so de Botton set up this this foundation, the idea of which was to put writers in residence in unusual places, and asked if there was somewhere I wanted to go. And it just seemed crazy to me to go anywhere where I might end up in my normal life, even if I had to pay for it. Which, of course, is pretty much a last resort for me. But, you know, so it really, when I was thinking of where I might go, of course, there were lots of interesting places to go, but I quickly narrowed that down to somewhere, you know, complete, you know, that I just wouldn't be allowed into. So almost at the first kind of thing, that narrowed itself down to a military thing, really. And also I'd become increasingly interested in the military. I mean, I'd had a long-standing interest in military history, but I went through this weird phase where I'd become really obsessed by the U.S. Marine Corps. Now, I'm not so stupid that I thought the aircraft carrier was run by the Marines,
right.
But I was tempted for a while to try to get into Camp Pendleton or Fort Pendleton, whatever it's called. And then I thought, in a way, you know, an aircraft carrier was even more remote possibility.
You could have just enlisted.
At my age, they probably wouldn't have me.
Yeah.
You know, and I chose an aircraft carrier in the way that sometimes, you know, you sort of enroll on these competitions, and they say, remember, your first choice might not be available. And then, to my astonishment, it, you know, de Botton called back and said, oh yeah, that's fine, you're on, you know, or rather you're off.
Yeah.
To you know, so I flew to Bahrain in a normal plane, and the next thing I'm flying from the big US Navy base there to a carrier.
Yeah, landing on a postage stamp or a griddle, depending on how you want to see it.
Yeah, and that was all very... you know, I like to do sort of daring things as long as the person responsible for my safety is not me. And so we did that. You know, they said if we miss the arresting wire, we'll go round again. And we're on this plane of about 12 people, and we sort of come down, and the flight attendant, that's not her proper name, she said, if it looks like we're missing the arresting wire, I'll make this gesture. And sure enough, she did. We're going in. And then we did what they call a bolter in the trade. So I was glad to have that sort of experience, you know, of landing on the aircraft carrier like that. It was, you know, I was going to say I don't want to boast, but then I realized I'm here partly yeah. to boast. This is not the first time I've done something like this. Back in the 1990s, I got a chance, probably the single most expensive free trip that I've had, when after the end of the Cold War, the former Soviet Union had all this surplus sort of stuff, and they started selling holiday flights in MiGs to wealthy tourists. So I actually flew supersonically in a MiG 29. Ooh. I mean, when I say flew, I was not piloting it, of course, but
was moved to.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, I always like this kind of thing.
Yeah. One of the things that shines through in the book, in between the descriptions of your 6'4" frame trying to fit in between bulkheads and, as Louise mentioned, the food, the lodgings, although you did have, miraculously, your own private lodging.
Yeah.
You and the snapper.
Yeah. Oh, I should have said that. Or maybe Louise said that, you know, each of the writers on this writers in residence thing is accompanied by a photographer, a magnum photographer. In my case, Christel Perkins, who, to my surprise, was really not so happy when he read the, when he got the proof of the book and found he'd been referred to throughout only as the snapper. anyway, he went along with that. Anyway, sorry. I had my own room. And do you know, the other day, something funny happened. I accidentally Googled myself. I don't know if this has ever happened.
Not by accident, I've never.
And, you know, a lot of the people who don't like the book, who, and there are a lot of them, you know, they take this, the fact that I insisted on my own room, as a real sign of symptomatic of its many shortcomings. And I can see in some way that I sort of should perhaps have shared rooms with people, but it filled me with such horror. And, you know, the idea was I was going to be sharing a room with five officers, which was considered an upgrade from the kind of lower ratings who are often in a dorm of 200 people. Yeah. Whereas for me, actually, I feel that the worst possible situation would have been to have been sharing a room just with the snapper. Or anybody else, for that matter. Sharing a room with five other people would have been better than sharing a room with one. I'd rather have been in the dorm with another 200 people than just five.
Right, than in dread premium economy.
Exactly, that's right. But, you know, it was really, although it was experientially perhaps a mistake, it was, the days were so unlike my normal days. They were so action-packed, and there was so much happening that each, you know, I'd see something absolutely extraordinary and then, you know, would try to take that in. That would be overlain half an hour later by another kind of extraordinary encounter. So it was really great to be able to go back to my room and just have some time to myself where I could very quickly begin, you know, noting it all down.
Yeah. I mean, in between bouts of head ducking and things, what comes through in the book is your sense of the extraordinary, quiet, dead solid competence of every single person aboard the ship. I mean, it's sort of, you know, like a Howard Hawks movie writ large. Everybody is really good at what they do and works really well with everyone else who's really good at what they do. And there's a sense that should all of this silent American precision and competence be turned toward war, watch out. But in the meanwhile, boy, is this literally and figuratively a well-oiled machine.
Well, yes, except in a way, I mean, we don't need to narrow it down to the aircraft carrier. We could just, because I come from this country where nothing works, England, where there's this almost Soviet-style resignation to things not working.
Why don't the English build computers? They haven't figured out how to make them leak oil.
Off the cuff or up the sleeve?
I'll never tell.
One of the reasons that, you know, British people like coming to America is because of that, you know, traditional, pragmatic, can-do thing, and things work here. And so I knew I was going to like being on the carrier, and if you like, the carrier is just a sort of concentration, an intensification of that general all-round American efficiency, and that kind of, you know, that classic, you know, gag about America. You know, the answer is yes, now what's the question? You know, I come from a country where the answer is no, and don't even bother asking the question. You know? So all of that was going to be appealing to me. But I guess the striking thing about the carrier, you see, is that, I mean, people are very, very young. The average age is about 21 or something. There's a lot of people. They've joined up. If they weren't in the Navy, they'd be doing some really shitty job somewhere. So these are people who are approximately college age, and I don't know what you did in college.
You were, I think, the tallest, and with the exception of the dentist, the oldest person in a ship full of how many people?
5,000 people. Yeah. I mean, it's just the most incredible thing, isn't it? It's one of the most mysterious things in life. It's after a certain point in one's life, it's the only question. How did I get to be so old? It just doesn't make sense. But I mean, you know, I was struck by the way I thought about what I was like as a sort of 19, 20-year-old, and just how few obligations I had. My obligation was solely to go to one tutorial a week, you know, and the rest of the time, you know, I was reading Dickens, but I was, it's just, you know, college is a very hedonistic time. So it was the contrast between my memory of what me and my college friends were like at that age with these, you know, guys who didn't really have much opportunity, and the, you know, the dedication and maturity that they brought to the task. Admittedly, you know, they didn't have any choice. You know, you make a choice to join the military, and from the moment you sign your name, most choices are taken out of your hands.
Yeah. I couldn't help but noticing that there's a copy of the book here. And if it's possible, could you read us a passage just so that we, those of us who haven't read the book, can get a sense of the acute observations, the loopy rhythms, and the utter strangeness of the world that you found yourself in?
Yeah, I would very happily read. I think what I'll do, actually, because... So it starts off as really quite a sort of orthodox reportage. And in a sense, this was the most... Well, two things. I would take a certain amount of pride in the sort of structural innovations of my other books. I think formally, structurally, they've all been quite interesting. Structurally, there's nothing interesting going on in this book. You know, it starts with me getting off on the boat, ends with me getting off it. And then the other thing is, initially it was the most boring book that I'd written for a very simple reason, because I had this, most of the books had been written to find out about a subject. You know, why did I love jazz so much? Why, 90 years after it ended, was I still so affected by the First World War? Or why did I love Tarkovsky's film so much? The books of journeys of discovery. In this case, there was an experience that I'd had. While I was having the experience, I knew exactly what I thought of it. And all I had to do then was transcribe the experience. And it wasn't till quite late in the day that it, during the rewriting, that it became fun. And this was a bit where it really does start to become much more of a book by me. And it picks up with that quotation, that little passage that you read, actually. So this will be self-explanatory, I think. Oh, just one thing to say. I'd met this very swaggering pilot called Disney. I was really drawn to him because he flew solo F-18s. Some F-18s are two-seaters, and he said really contemptuously, a two-seater fighter plane, that's got a pilot in it and a piece of self-loading baggage in the other seat. So I really liked his sort of Top Gun approach. And then when we spoke more privately, he was saying that, you know, when he lands at night, you know, it's really dangerous still, all this stuff. And he said sometimes he lands the plane at night, and he sits there in the cockpit, and he's landed, and he sits there, his leg is trembling uncontrollably, and he's bathed in sweat. So, you know, it takes its toll on people. That's a little bit of background. One of the last pictures the snapper took before heading back to the beach — the beach is the sort of metonym for the mainland — one of the last pictures he took was the one he'd had in mind right from the start, from our first morning on the boat. The infinite mirror of corridors at night, lit by the red glow of safety lights when there was little foot traffic, and a long exposure allowed the walkways to reflect on their own immensity. I'd been struck by this hall of mirrors thing myself, had jotted down variants of that phrase, infinite mirror effect, tunnel of mirrors, in my exercise book. It was a good thing to have noticed. Then, after I got back to London, I read Tom Wolfe's 1975 essay, The Truest Sport, Jousting with Sam and Charlie, about pilots flying missions from a carrier during the Vietnam War. Wolfe had been through the walkways too, had noticed the way that as you look on and through these hatchways, one after the other, it's like a hall of mirrors. I read it with a steady, oh shit, sensation of self-confidence draining away. And the hatchways were only part of my worries. I'd ended up feeling less conspicuous on the boat, not Didianly invisible, but more at ease and confident around the people I ran into every day. I cracked more jokes, expressed my personality a bit more. The downside was that I'd ended up feeling less and less confident about the work I was supposed to be doing. For the previous year or so, I'd been more admiring of the books of reportage coming out of Afghanistan and Iraq than almost any of the novels I'd been reading in the same period. What skill it took to notice and to record stuff, often in the midst of danger that was real and immediate. Whereas I had trouble recording even the simplest things, such as someone's name and rank. The longer I spent on the carrier, the more convinced I became that of all the kind of writers I was not, a reporter was top of the list. As a reporter, Wolf also had the advantage that his pilots were flying real combat missions, and they even ended up getting shot down and ejected over the sea. But there was no getting away from the simple, non-circumstantial truth. The Truest Sport was a brilliant piece of reporting and writing, impossible to improve on except insofar as, oh, I got myself into a right old state. The way that I kept circling back to that phrase, except insofar as, was proof of that. I mean, what kind of phrase was that? What kind of writer would use that even once? Except one who was caught like a rabbit in the headlights of another writer's brilliance. Like a rabbit in the headlights. I was in the infinite feedback loop, a mirror hall of self-doubt, intensified by the way that Wolf improved on his unimprovable essay with The Right Stuff. Taking off and landing from a carrier had gotten safer since the time of Wolf's essay. But in essentials, the carrier experience hadn't changed significantly since Vietnam or since the Second World War. It's all about noisy planes taking off and landing on a platform, on a flat platform in the middle of the ocean. Wolf likens it to a heaving, greasy skillet. It's about that and large numbers of people living together in cramped conditions, eating greasy skillet food. Photographs of life on board a carrier in the build-up to the Battle of Midway are remarkably like ones you could take today, like the ones the snapper had been snapping. Allow for small adjustments in clothing and technology, and the pictures were practically identical. Much is made of the swagger and confidence of pilots, especially Navy pilots, the one who land on carriers the size of skillets. But confidence is essential to writing too. You can't do it without talent, but you can't do it without confidence either. And Wolf had taken a shark-sized bite out of mine. Once your confidence goes, other things start to go with it. You fall into depression. You begin to dread the page, the words, the futility of putting the latter on the former. I was like a pilot in the process of losing it. The veteran of thousands of arrested landings and catapulted launches, who just can't do it anymore, who gets the shakes at the mere thought of being hurled off the deck and into the black dog of night, constantly on the brink of seeing the ship's psychiatrist and telling him that he can't do it anymore, that a zero defect mentality has given way to a zero ability mentality, to zero ability. Lying awake at night, knowing that the thing he is, a pilot, a Navy pilot, is really the thing he was. That it's only a matter of time, before others find out too. So by the time he gets suited up and ready to go, he's already exhausted and used up. Climbs into the cockpit, connects all the tubes and harnessing, goes through the checks and is shocked to discover all over again what he's been discovering for a while now, that there's no place on earth he'd rather not be. Still able to process all the information and data coming his way from the flight deck and the instrument panels, but none of it sufficient to drown out the words that are sounding through his head. Abort, 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 and eject, eject, eject. But who sits there and braces and gives the thumbs up and hangs on as, once again, he's flung out to sea. Who's maybe okay while he's airborne and up there, flying the mission, on cruise control, enjoying the view, but who feels sweat trickling down his ribs as the time comes to take his place in the recovery formation, who is convinced that this time he's going to slam into the fantail, that he comes in too high, misses all the arresting wires and bolts, which means he's got to go round again, got to go round and come back and do the whole damn thing again, which has become more difficult as a result of that earlier failure. If only, he thinks, he could be one of the guys on the deck, watching the planes come in, not doing it himself, just observing others doing it, not writing it, just reading about it. So
What I love about that passage, and it's very much echoed in a lot of your books, is that no matter what the ostensible subject matter and no matter where you start, how quickly we circle the drain into despair and the impossibility of writing, which is my favorite subject. Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit, you know, the title of this evening is How I Turned Into the Writer I Am Not. Mm. But I also want to talk about how your books again and again turn into the books they are not. The first book of yours I read was your book on D.H. Lawrence, which that's really the wrong way of describing it, because it certainly starts out being a book about the impossibility of writing a book about D.H. Lawrence, or at least a book about the impossibility of your ever writing a book about D.H. Lawrence. And then by sort of slow, sneaky, accretive steps, D.H. Lawrence kind of seeps into the book, but then you chase him away with your own self-doubt and self-deprecation, and then sort of little bits of Lawrence come in, and then, of course, you expel them again by, it seems like only if you loudly proclaim that you can't write about him can you begin to write about him, but once you start to write about him, that just proves the impossibility, and you go round and round and round until you have a book which is full of delicious despair, but then at the end, you know, I came for the despair, but left actually learning huge amounts about Lawrence, whether I wanted to or not.
Yeah.
But I just want to talk about the process where, you know, the Lawrence book, which started out about Lawrence and became a book about how that book couldn't come into being, or But Beautiful, your book on jazz, which I think, in addition to being an extraordinary book, also has probably the best title for a book about jazz that will ever, has ever been written or will ever be. That started out, I gather, as a nonfiction book, but then you found the only way you could tell it was as a fiction book.
Yeah.
How do your books turn around and defeat your intention again and again and again? What's that process like?
Yeah, okay, so we've now moved to the kind of the heart of the evening, haven't we, really?
Yeah, sort of impossibility and why one can't write.
Yeah, and that title, the title of this evening, when we were all discussing what the title, I remember coming up with that and thinking how clever it was. And now, actually, I can't quite remember exactly what it meant. But I guess, there's various ways, things we could sort of address, really. I mean, it's, I guess when I was at university, there was a, if you wanted to be a writer, it meant you wanted to be a novelist. And, you know, and I did like the idea of being a writer, but I was so lacking in many of the things that a novelist needed. Zero ability to think of stories, that kind of thing. Not very good at dialogue, all of that. So there was an immediate sort of falling short. So I guess quite a lot of my writing life has been a question of how do I sort of get by lacking. I'm glad that's your book, not mine, by the way. Lacking many of the things which might have been considered indispensable for doing what you're doing. But then that quickly became a sort of liberating thing for me. And so I'll actually illustrate this by talking about a book that you didn't mention, my book about the First World War, The Missing of the Somme. Because I'm not good at conveying information and all this kind of stuff, and I find it boring sort of conveying factual stuff, you know, I just didn't bother. I thought, okay, I'm not going to bother trying to do all that stuff. And in the case of the First World War, because there are so many books about the First World War, there was no need for another factual book about the First World War, just as there was no need for yet another biography of Lawrence. So that meant that I could just concentrate on the little, on the particular thing that I had going for me. And I always come back to that, you know, that great Diane Arbus line when she says something like, you know, but I still think I've got some little take on some corner of things. So I felt I could sort of turn or use all of my, instead of trying to paper over my inadequacies, I could use them as the base. I wouldn't try to, I've used this metaphor before. It's like in tennis, if you've got a dodgy backhand, you're not going to get anywhere. So you have to devote all of your energy to improving your backhand. Because otherwise, you know, what are they going to do? They're going to hit your backhand. Now, it seems to me as a writer, you really don't need to do that. You can just say, you know what? I won't use my backhand at all.
Right. So basically, I don't have a command of the facts. I don't understand plot. I can't do dialogue. So let's figure out how to write, using that as a feature rather than a bug.
Exactly. And, you know, and I think really important to my arriving at that was the jazz book. Because, you know, so many of the jazz people, if you look at, you know, footage famously of Monk playing the piano, you know, Monk, great, great pianist, and he's doing it all wrong. His hands are not as they're meant to be. Or, you know, an even more extreme example, somebody like Django Reinhardt, who you might have thought suffered from the really, you know, problematic thing for a guitar player of his hands being all, what happened? He got, they were in a fire or something like that. So I very much was inspired by this thing of actually debility playing a really crucial part in how they developed their own sound.
I can't tell you how inspiring that is to hear.
it is.
It's, no, I'm serious.
Really encouraging. Yeah. And it's, you know, in jazz as well, you know, I mean, I became so interested in the history of jazz and just in the trumpet. You know, you trace the whole history of the trumpet through everyone trying to sound like the guy before them, failing to do so, and as a result, arriving at their unique sound. You know, perhaps most spectacularly, you know, Miles Davis. He just couldn't do the high register thing that, you know, God, Dizzy, Roy Eldridge, Roy Armstrong, Louis Armstrong had done. Yeah. So yeah, and I guess fortunately, I had the. It's one of the. I just had the sort of confidence to do this, and there was a price to be paid for this, but I was mercifully free of this anxiety. There was one thing that many writers find it really difficult to do without, but which I sort of really was untroubled by, and that was an audience. There was no audience for this kind of stuff, but it didn't matter because, you know, I was kind of in it for me.
Before you made a virtue of what you claimed to be your shortcomings as a writer, and if the evening were longer, I would disprove that point by point by point.
I think we'd be all happy to stick around.
Well, let's see what we can do. But a lot of the earliest writing I know of yours, before you started disclaiming the fact that you were really good at it, took place in that period of life between the end of college and the beginning of real life, this sort of wild, protracted, post-collegiate little period, but stretched out and prolonged.
To the present.
Almost indefinitely. You know, sort of, you know, in a really kind of tantric way.
Yeah.
What is it about that stretch that so fascinated you and that you came to write so uniquely well about?
Yeah, well, I mean, we have to go back, I think, I've come to realize now, and I've come to realize now that there is something very special about that post-college phase anyway. My particular experience, though, of it, I mean, I do need to particularize my experience in that I left university at a time of sort of massive unemployment, where there was really no hope of getting a job. But at the same time, it was the sort of Thatcher, Reagan period, but at the same time, all of the earlier welfare provisions were still in place. So if, like me, you'd come from an Oxford college where your only obligation was to attend a tutorial once a week, to then move on to a life where all you had to do was sign on the dole, first of all, once a week, and then as the sort of unemployment numbers went up, it got to the point we only had to sign on once every 2 months. It was just wonderful, especially since the Oxford educational system was very much about self, you know, teaching yourself how to math. You know, it was just a continuation of my Oxford life. But whereas if I'd continued on in, say, if I'd done a PhD, you know, where the whole thrust of the educational process I'd been through had been like towards greater and greater specialism, 8 O levels as we call them, 3 A levels, at which I got the highest possible grades. I mean, it remains my greatest achievement. So rather pathetically, 30 years later, I'm still talking about it or whatever. So, you know, you do 3 A-levels and then a single degree. I did English. And then after that, you know, then you can really specialise in a PhD. You know, I found the opposite was happening as a result of doing an English degree. I'd sort of thought, oh, you know, I'd encountered a few paintings. I was starting to become interested in all sorts of stuff. And fortunately for me at that age, I was living with but mainly other sort of unemployed graduates. And, you know, we discovered all of these writers who were so important to me, firstly because they offered a way of being a creative writer that didn't involve being just a novelist, but also they just, you know, they were not specialists. And, you know, I've written so much about these people, you know, John Berger was so important to me, who persuaded me that you didn't need to encourage me to, that you didn't have to be an expert or a specialist to write about things. Susan Sontag, you know, who said, you know, her definition of being a writer was precisely somebody who's interested in everything. Encountered all of these sort of people. And so there was this kind of very poorly funded kind of safety net set up by the state for all sorts of people like me. And there's that, this is a line I've quoted before, there's that singer who's rather dropped out of sight now called Roland Gift, who was with that band, sure, the Fine Young Cannibals.
He was the guy with that hairline.
Yes, exactly that, yeah. You know, and he said, really, I think he really nailed this. He said, you know, what you have to understand is that the Dole supported a whole generation of would-be writers, artists, dancers, musicians in England. So that was the moment that I was a very grateful beneficiary of. But I think generally, and I really became aware of this when I was teaching graduates in Iowa, you know, when you do your undergraduate degree, you're sort of accumulating all these, you know, all this, a certain amount of knowledge, and you're acquiring the skills to continue educating yourself. And then after that, you can bring those skills into a much sort of wider range of things. And it's just, you know, and also your brain is at that particular, your brain is still able to absorb a huge amount of stuff, and you're encountering all sorts of things for the first time. You're probably seeing some of the what will become your favorite films. You know, you're probably listening to serious music, all this kind of stuff. You know, it's just a wonderful, magical time in people's lives if you're lucky enough to arrange your circumstances in such a way that you've got the time to do it.
In Paris Trance, which is also set in that sort of, the long durée of post-collegiate life, you know, the old is dying, the new cannot yet be born. In the interim, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear.
Gramsci.
Yeah. But in Paris Trance, one of the things that people do with this sort of gloriously wasted period that both opens up before them and that they manufacture for their lives is go to a lot of movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the most sort of glorious set of descriptions of the joys of just movie going that I know of.
Yeah.
And I want to use that as a way of talking about, you know, you talked about the obligation of a writer is to write about everything. You don't have to be a specialist.
Let's say the privilege of a writer rather than obligation.
Okay. Then the privilege of a writer being that one can write about everything. I really love the fact that you wrote a book about a book that big about one single film, Tarkovsky's stalker, which I think is all the more revelatory for the fact that it doesn't come out of the kind of pomegranate seedy world of film studies, mm-hmm. but comes out of just your delight as a viewer and your reveling in the impossibility of describing what you're seeing.
Yes, that's absolutely... Well,
And your love of puddles, which you and Tarkovsky share.
What's a pun in Tarkovsky?
Puddle.
Puddles.
You know, big things of water that you step in and feel and get soggy from.
Yes, indeed, yeah. No, it's... Like I'm sure many of you, I love David Thompson's Biographical Dictionary of Cinema, and you'll remember in one of the... You know, there's the key entry in that where he lists all the films that he went to see at the National Film Theatre in London, in particular, pretty much, you know, I think in his early 20s, that kind of stuff. I should say as well, Paris Trance is, of course, set in Paris, and Paris remains, you know, the very best city that I've ever been to for seeing films.
Still is.
Yeah. And there's, you know, now it's, in, you know, again, this is a fortunate thing about when I was... about my, you know, all of the films of the past were available to be seen. So there were late night screenings every night that I was an undergraduate in Oxford. So at the same time I was doing my English degree, you know, there was a sort of casual, informal film history course going on. And then when I lived in Paris, I was able to you know, fill in the gaps. Now, it's a kind of funny thing. There's two things going on. On the one hand, you know, we're living in a period now whereby if I say to you, the passenger, Antonioni, if you were discreet about it, you could probably actually press a few buttons and start watching it now on your little phone. And that's kind of great. In contrast to that, you know, it's something that David Thompson was even more aware of. You know, you were completely at the mercy, really, of when films were on in certain things. And that meant that you saw them in cinemas, you know, properly. And it also just meant it was a bigger sort of experience. So, you know, you would see that this film you'd been wanting to watch for a while was on at a particular cinema. And a little kind of, some sort of little, it would be an event in your life in a way that watching a film on your... But, you know, it's sort of devoid of circumstance. In the case of the Tarkovsky film, which is about, you know, people making a trip to this place, the zone, you know, in the case of that film, it was particularly intense, really. And I saw that film so many times and kept seeing it. And it was also one of those films whereby, you know, it so shaped my sense of what a film could be, in a way that now a young person, their sense of what a film could be might be shaped now by, I don't know, The Great Beauty or something.
Yeah, and I think also I'm of that generation where I can say that every film that changed my life, and there were many of them, I saw as a film.
As a film, in the movie theater. Yeah, exactly.
And not in a kind of platform agnostic way. I don't know how much time we have, but if you could read... I just think your celebration of Tarkovsky, of Stalker, of that film's particular lugubrious drollery is kind of wonderful. And if you could read a passage from it for us, I would be grateful.
Sure. And you're right to emphasize the drollery. I mean, the thing about Stalker is it more than any other film I can think of, it has to be seen in the theater. And that's really unfortunate because it's actually impossible to see it in the theater.
Well, there you go again.
You know, there are problems with the rights. And I think at the moment there's only one print, which is working so hard, which is kind of servicing the whole of Western Europe. So each time I see it, it's deteriorated a bit further. But... You know, what is the zone that they go to? Well, the zone is the wonder of cinematic space, and you just can't. I mean, there's this great bit of a great lecture by John Berger called "Every Time We Say Goodbye" about the about cinema, and he says, you know, when you go into a movie theater, you know, the screen, he says, it's like a sky, whereas when you watch a television, he says, it's a little cupboard. You know, and then it's a great Berger thing. He says, of course that's true. I mean, where would film stars come from if not a filmic sky? I really think you need to. I'll read you a little. As you know, they go into this place, the zone. So it's a really thrilling film because it begins, first of all, as an actual physical journey. And then the nearer the three of them get to this place, the room, where it's alleged your deepest wish will come true, the more their physical progress is impeded as they get bogged down in increasingly philosophical, metaphysical discussions. So this book, which is a kind of summary of the film, and to go back to our early point, as some of you might know, this really was, in some ways, my greatest achievement. This is my most successful book, in that I was commissioned to write a book about tennis, which I didn't have any. I found I had no desire to write, and then just to sort of get out of despair of not writing the tennis book, I just started for my own enjoyment summarizing the film Stalker, and then when the publishers asked how's it going, I'd say, oh, it's going really well, actually. And then the point came when I handed in this book, and it was like they said, it's about, didn't we say tennis? I said, no. And they to their great credit, although they could justifiably have said that I hadn't fulfilled the terms of the contract, they both in Britain and America, they went ahead and published it. And, I'm not joking when I say about, that for me is, I really was, to be able to publish a book like this with about a film that so few people have, relatively few people have seen, there's the John Grisham style of success, and then there's this. Anyway, so let's see. Yeah. So remember, there's this place that called The Room where it's alleged your deepest desire in life might come true. We think we have huge goals in life, but actually when it comes to it, we'll settle quite happily for something trivial that we've had all the time and which made our lives bearable. I remember one of several conversations with my mum and dad about what they'd do if they won the football pools. The football pools. That, for many British people, was their equivalent of the room, the thing that would make all their wishes come true. All I'd like to do, my mum said, with a mixture of pride and humbleness, is to go down to the supermarket and buy the nicest piece of steak there. That's all I want. You could do that now, I yelled. Because what she really wanted was to forego the thing, or things actually, because she could probably have afforded to eat steak from the supermarket every day for the rest of her life. She wanted to forego the things that she claimed she wanted. On one occasion, when my wife and I took my parents out for dinner, an unusual event as they hated going to restaurants, we were surprised to see that my mum had actually eaten all of her steak. Then, when we got back home, we found that she'd squirreled half of it away and brought it home wrapped up in a napkin in her handbag. These meat-related sources of regret seemed to run deep in my family. When my mother was in the early stage of what proved to be her terminal illness, my father said that on occasions she did buy steak from the supermarket, always the very cheapest cuts, and it was never very nice. He also said that he had regrets about their diet of the last 50 years. He wished that they had eaten more fat. Not meat, fat. Well, that would have been an excellent wish to have taken into the room. Imagine, your deepest wish is that you'd eaten more fat. This is to slightly misrepresent the room, however, for Stalker never claims that the room's powers are retrospective. You can go into the room and eat all the fat you like from now on. But you can't transform the life you have led into one in which, even during the lean years, you ate heaps of fat. But perhaps this is and always will be one's deepest wish, to have the terms of the offer slightly amended so that it can be retrospectively applied, to build a time machine, to go back and have another go, another punt, another throw of the dice, this time knowing the result in advance. The question then, I suppose, is this. Is one's deepest desire always the same as one's greatest regret? And I'll answer that question in a way by saying, if you're American, no. If you're English, almost certainly yes.
Great. I won't very much open this up to questions, but just very briefly, particularly since you mentioned your mom and dad in that passage. In Another Great Day at Sea, the book kind of is bookended by very brief, elusive mentions of your mom and dad. Mm. And in between, there's no mention of them at all, but they're sort of like the structuring absence of that book. If you could, before we open it up for questions, just talk about, from this vantage point, the role your mom and your dad played in helping make you the writer you are and how you turned into the writer you aren't.
Yeah, you know, it's, certainly. I mean, I'm so conscious now, if we were going to hear a Beethoven recital tonight, you know, you can guarantee there'd be a bunch of, you know, four-year-old kids there, because there is this thing where parents now want to make sure their kids have enjoyed all the riches of Western and probably Eastern civilization as well by the time they're five at the latest. And, you know, looking back, I count it one of the huge privileges of my life that I grew up in a house with no books at all and where we had no music at all, because then when I discovered it, and, you know, in that classic, you know, working class way, you know, I fell under the influence of a teacher at school and, you know, fell in love with literature. To cut a long story short, started reading books and, you know, end up here. And, you know, so I just went through that sort of process. But it was kind of funny, because when I passed all these O-levels, and then I was deciding which three subjects to do at A-level. And my dad, you know, I was going to do history, and he said, "Well, I wouldn't do history, Jeff. It's all in the past," which was one of his brilliant lines. And then the other great bit of advice he gave me, he said, you know, because he was very, very private, you know, when we'd go onto the beach, and you know, on the beach, he'd even wear his sunburn kind of thing. He'd never put anything in writing, Jeff. you know, so it was, all of that was kind of funny. And, you know, and there's a, it was in some ways, I mean, there was this lovely thing where I would always give my parents my copies of my books. And it was something I really loved. And so we had no books in the house at all, except for this sort of expanding shelf of all these different editions and translations of books by me. And it became a kind of shrine. I mean, not just a shrine in the way that every parent's house ends up being a shrine to their children, but this became a shrine to this weird object, the book, which could somehow mean that you could lead this kind of strange life whereby, because these books by me were all unread, which was a liberation, because I didn't have to worry about my mum reading all this stuff about, you know, drug taking in Paris and all that. There were just these things that enabled you to sort of earn a living without working, to sort of travel the world. And it was just, yeah, it became a kind of big thing. So it was this was the first book that I wrote that, you know, that I didn't, they were dead before this came out. It was the first one I didn't, wasn't able to give them, of course, and it was I really, really missed that, you know. Yeah, and now, of course, in that classic way of things, having spent so many years, whenever my parents would tell a story, I'd just be thinking, oh, just God, not again, I don't want to listen to this. And now, of course, in the classic way, I wish I'd listened much more to, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that I'm curious about now that the answers aren't readily accessible in the form of a monologue to which, if they were alive, I would certainly not have listened.
Well, my hope is that you find the room where, going forward, you get to hear all of that. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Does someone here have a question? If not, we can go on and again begin that point-by-point refutation of your...
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Wait, we've got...
So do you believe that that very fertile time in your 20s. Does that happen again in life? Have you found that to be true?
Oh, well, do you know, I don't have any kids, which has been a real source of enormous happiness to me. But I'm told that actually having kids, you at some point you sort of, you know, you start living, you know, you share their sort of discovery of things. What I'm really conscious of, certainly in the realm of writing, and I remember, you know, when I was, you know, when I was reading all these novels when I was 19 or something, each one of which was such a huge addition to my understanding of the world, and it was so partly because my circumstances were really quite circumscribed, and you know, it's increasingly rare, I think, to have that. I mean, it's, you know, okay, if you've read 10 books in your life, wow, they're going to have an effect on you. Now, I've read, I don't know how many tens of thousands of books or whatever, so the effect of each one typically is not so great. So that experience of being really overwhelmed by a book is increasingly rare. And I'd have to say, probably with music too. I mean, you know, it's I sort of stand by the point I make in the Zona book. There's something amazing about that period in one's early 20s, I think. Actually, I look back on that period now and I look at it so regretfully, because I think, shit, you know, I could play tennis for like 4 hours a day back then.
Here's a question.
Well, do you think we should be a little bit more patient? Are you always this impatient? At one point you gave them like 1 second.
I'm sorry. Please go ahead and take as long as you like.
Hey, Jeff, that was great. I just wondered, you've lived a lot of different places around the world, and I just wondered what, I don't think you have to go through all of them, I guess, but just could you talk about the different places and what they brought to your writing?
Oh, yeah, so I have, I mean, I got into this thing partly because, you know, I loved D.H. Lawrence so much, and it seemed crazy, and we never went anywhere on the holiday as a kid except to the sort of rainy English coastal things, so it wasn't in my sort of blood to move abroad at all, to live abroad, to go away. Yeah, I didn't go on a plane till I was about 23, I think. And then, you know, I just thought it would be a good thing, and I'd go on holidays and not really like it. And then I found the way that I did like was to go away for longer periods so I could have a routine, but in a new place. And it was great. And I look back on that phase now, and I'd go to live in, I went to live in New Orleans and New York and Paris. And God, I look back on it now and I think, how did I endure the loneliness of it? I mean, it was just because these weren't kind of residents, you know, I wasn't doing some sort of gig. I was just living in different places. And of course, in that way now, but I, you know, I look back on those phases so, I mean, they were just great creatively, those phases, even though I'd spend all my time in Paris, particularly just looking in at bars, thinking, seeing people leading the lives that I wanted to lead. And I knew some English people, and they all had French girlfriends. Why? I was the only English guy in Paris who couldn't get a French girlfriend. It was just, it's kind of pathetic, really. But anyway, I think another thing as well is that back then, without the internet, I think it really was good for sort of, it really moved me away from sort of essay writing, and it was good for writing fiction because of not having, access to sort of books so much. And, you know, I was apprehensive, you know, if you're in a new country, even being in a traffic jam is sort of interesting. So there was that, there was all of that going on, and in their different ways, they were all incredibly, it was great. And I found it incredibly irritating. I couldn't really speak any languages, and I used to just get in these incredible, you know, in London, I was used to sort of expressing my personality and making jokes. And then in Paris, you know, suddenly my most intense relationships were with people's cats and dogs as I sat there at dinner, just sort of nodding and smiling, you know, desperately trying to construct some pun in my head, by which time the conversation had moved on to, I don't know, to something else. Yeah.
So I know that you don't have kids, as you said, and I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about your observations of having kids, not having kids, as it relates to the life of a writer.
Oh, yeah. Well, well, I don't know. I mean, I'm in a sense, I'm not... The whole thing of having kids just seems to me hellish. But I think that's maybe because I didn't have any brothers or sisters. So I didn't have this whole sort of family kind of chaos kind of thing. You know, I'd be out playing with my friends, which I liked, then I'd go back home and it was all kind of quiet in a way. So, and it's just been, I mean, I guess the main thing for me, I think as a result of that, I've always had plenty of the combination of not having kids and not having a job has really freed up quite a lot of time. But the incredible thing is, as you get older, it whizzes by anyway. But yeah, that would be. It's meant that I've been able to just continue this sort of post collegiate life for a long, long while, as we were saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, you see, look, there's loads of hands now. There's a forest of hands.
And I'm sitting on mine.
thank you. Sometimes when I'm reading some of your work, you write mostly in the first person, but then on occasion I get the feeling that you aren't actually your narrator. Like in Death in Varanasi, you kind of disappear into the whole life there, but, you know, here you are.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your relationship with your narrator or the fiction I guess, reportage that you are, that world where you're living in the middle of.
Yeah, sure. Well, Death in Varanasi is, although I say it myself, quite interesting in that the first part is third person, then the second part is first person. And in the first part, in the third person, the guy is called Jeff Atman, but it's Jeff with a J, you know, emphasizing that it's fiction. So although there are certain physical resemblances and all of this kind of stuff, yeah, it's not, it, you know, that it, yeah, that it's a novel. And then in part two, I guess it's more like the kind of thing that I might be writing in my own voice. But, you know, the persona or whatever is always a construct, and it just comes out of a kind of tone, really. And nearly always, you know, when I'm writing it's a book, it's the arrival at some kind of tone that is a tone that's appropriate to the subject. And at the same time, I've always had this strange thing as a writer that however hard I've tried to sound like other people, you know, in reference to what we were saying earlier, still, you know, even when I was going through my most intense Roland Barthes phase, you know, Roland Barthes, the ultimate sort of, you know, sort of sophisticated Parisian writer, it would still come out with this sort of Jeff Dyer from Gloucestershire kind of. So it was like Roland Barthes in Gloucestershire. So there was always that kind of quality to it, you know. So yeah, but I've always found it quite boring when I'm just transcribing something that's really happened. So really all of the non-fiction, except for this one, it's really every, you know, nearly everything has been, you know, exaggerated, enhanced, altered. And that doesn't matter in a way it would if you were writing a straightforward non-fiction book, because none of the stuff that's going on is of any... It doesn't matter to anyone whether it really happened or not. It's not like we would all feel justifiably cheated if we read that book about the guy cutting his hand off in the canyon in Utah. You know, that would really... Or if somebody was writing a history book and they altered stuff. But this is just... These are just tiny alterations which take place nearly always for the sake of sort of either the story or just some sort of psychological thing. I've joked before that nearly always I start enjoying writing a non-fiction experiential piece when I spy the opportunity to make myself seem even more of a jerk than I am in real life. And that's nearly always the point when it becomes fun for me. You know, and I get a little grin on my face and I, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about your writing process. For example, do you work on multiple projects at the same time, one project? Do you keep to a schedule? I mean, you kind of wonderfully portray this sort of slacker ambiance in your work oftentimes, but I'm thinking, man, this guy is so productive. I am so envious. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about sort of how you go about writing.
Yeah, do you know, I sort of share your envy. I'm kind of envious as well, because I certainly feel... Nice. Yeah, well, I can only talk about where I'm at now, really, which is I'm conscious that the more books I write, the more of writing, as that passage I read indicates, there's a real thing of, you know, the dread of writing. And I'm so conscious of the difference between musicians and writers. I know quite a few musicians. Basically, they wake up, they'll gobble down. What they want to be doing is playing music. They just can't wait to play music. It's so that nearly all the writers I know, they'll do anything to avoid. It's particularly difficult now with the World Cup on here and the time difference. You know, you get up in the morning, you've had your cereal. Oh, there's football to watch. So I just dread that, and I find I just can do it for such short periods of time, and then it's only when somehow I've managed to get out some sort of basic thing of it that then I can enjoy the rewriting of it. And I think that's probably not uncommon. The strange thing for me is that I've come to dislike what I might once have thought would be the fun initial creative part, and have come to increasingly love the kind of clerical aspect of it. And that's certainly getting worse. And book writing is setting off on a book. I'm not writing a book at the moment because I'm doing lots of different pieces. But, you know, I'm really aware now, like some, you know, just of what it is, of all the effort involved in writing a book that has to go before you get to the point where you're having to force yourself to be at the desk, before that lovely point arrives when for a while you are like a musician in that, oh yeah, great, get to my desk. But God, wading through it, the whatever it is you have to wade through to get to that point is a dreadful prospect. And in some ways, you know, I think when I was at school, the teacher would sometimes assign an essay to do over Christmas. And it was a horrible thing to do, and it was so terrible. I would always write that essay on either the Friday night or the Saturday morning of the vacation to get it out of the way. So in a weird way, I was sort of more easily self-disciplined at 16 and 17 than I am now 40 years later, as the dread has increased. I have an incredible feeling that we've ended up where we began. Let's go round again.
But I think the thing that we're all fortunate of is that when you find writing to be difficult or impossible, you find some way of telling us, your readers, how difficult or impossible it is. And after two or three or four pages of talking about how it can't be written, all of a sudden we're reading your writing and it just keeps going on. And there's both a kind of, whether you intend it or not, a lovely reassurance in that sense that no matter how utterly impossible it is for you to write or us to write or any of us to write, but here it is and we continue to read it and you continue to write it. And oh, then there's this other stuff going on too. And it's really beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you, Howard, and thank you all. Thank you so much, Howard.
Yay. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.